Welcome to the Inquire Mind podcast with me, Stanley Goldberg. Today, I'll be speaking with Bobby Duffy. Bobby Duffy is a professor of public policy and the director of the Policy Institute at King's College London. He has worked across most public policy areas in his career of nearly 30 years in public research and evaluation, including being seconded to the Prime Minister's Strategy Unit. His most recent book, The Generation Myth, Why When You're Born Matters Less Than You Think, was published on November 9th, 2021 by Basic Books. On this podcast, we discuss polarization, whether it's real or overblown, what effect different generations actually have versus what we think they have, and numerous other topics. As always, thank you very much for listening to the podcast. And if you wish to support the podcast, please consider subscribing on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, as well as on YouTube. So now, without further delay, here's my podcast with Bobby Duffy. Bobby Duffy, welcome to the Inquire Mind podcast.
Great to be here. Thank you for the invite.
Yeah, it's a real pleasure. So I'm looking forward to discussing your upcoming book, The Generation Myth, Why When You're Born Matters Less Than You Think. And for the people that are viewing this on YouTube, here's the physical copy. I was lucky enough to get an early copy. It was a very interesting read. So thank you for writing it and taking the time to explain, lay out your ideas in this book. So let's start with this. What motivated you to write this book?
I suppose the main thrust of the book is that generational thinking, what's truly different between generations, is a really big idea that has got a huge history in sociology and philosophy, but has been utterly lost in recent decades in a mess of stereotypes and myths and cliches about generations, where fake differences are created or exaggerated between generations for all sorts of motivations. And that's a real shame, because aside from those myths and stereotypes, there are really important differences in the context for different birth cohorts that are shaping lives in different sorts of ways, but we can't really see them because they're lost in this mess. So that's really the thrust of the book, that this is an important idea, but only if we separate the myth from reality.
When was the first time that you realized that there's something to this? Was there not to quote Oprah, but like an aha moment?
Yeah, it's really interesting, because it was sort of my genesis of interest in it probably started with Bob Putnam's Bowling Alone, where Bob laid out some really, really important trends that were true cohort differences in terms of people's trust in each other or social connection more generally. So I started looking at a broader set of attitudinal variables and behavioral variables across different countries to try to see if I could see similar patterns or different patterns in the UK and elsewhere. And then that was, you know, a good 20 years ago. But then that kind of sensitized me to looking for claimed generational differences. So when I started looking at that, you started to notice more and more frothy, made up generational differences, claims about generational differences. So I suppose it's the evolution. It wasn't so much an aha moment as an evolution of seeing, there's something really important here. But everything that I saw related to generations, or nearly everything that I saw related to generational types like millennials or Gen Z or baby boomers, was mostly nonsense. It was that spurred me to look at it more carefully, was that disconnect between some really important things that people had pointed out and what you would see most normally in the media and social media about claimed generational differences. And it was like the weight of the number of those myths and stereotypes was the thing that stood out you've got this constant increasing flow of bad research or made up claims.
Right. And when did this, I guess, the science of generations and breaking down people by generations begin?
Yeah, I mean, it's got a long history, and a lot of, very old thought thinks about generations as, a group of people, where it quite often, even in, hundreds of years ago, people were talking about 15 to 20 year kind of cycles, where you would have different characteristics within cohorts that would feed through. But I guess the way that we think about generations now was informed a lot by the thinkers that around the turn of the 20th century, and particularly around the First World War in Europe, where you had sociologists like Karl Mannheim in particular, who gave us brought together a lot of ideas around how generations are formed into particular identities, mostly through traumatic experience, was Mannheim's perspective on this, because he had seen the impact of the First World War on whole cohorts of young people who were effectively sacrificed by older people, and that created this sense of division between young and old in those days. But he also did talk about how slow evolutionary change in culture pulls generations apart. And so that type of thinking, which built on people like Auguste Comte, the French philosopher, who thought of generational differences as effectively how societies change, or one of the key components of how societies change, that young people naturally come into society less configured to the attitudes, beliefs, values, and behaviors of previous generations. And so they help move society forward. So these are really big ideas, sort of based on the fundamentals of society, that we are born, we age, and we die as individuals, but society flows on being renewed all the time. And the second part being that we're more flexible when we're young. And our formative years are really important in forming our values and attitudes and behaviors. And that type of thinking is still really important to how we understand generations today, or how we think about these types of social generations, like baby boomers through to Gen Z.
Right. And for example, the greatest generation had World War II, which defined for a lot of people that generation and maybe shaped their thinking. How about for a generation like millennials or Gen Z, which I believe I fall under? What features of society have shaped those generations' behaviors, or why were they, placed in this category of millennials or Gen Z?
Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, I think there is one of the criticisms of the social generations that we have now, these categories, is there is no real scientific basis to where do you draw the boundaries and how do you define these groups. There sort of is with baby boomers, because that's related to a demographic event of higher birth rates post-war in the US and a number of countries in Europe, although not all. But after that, it becomes a little bit more fuzzy on why Gen X? Why is Gen X roughly born 1966 to 1979? Then why have we put millennials at roughly 1980 to 1995, and then Gen Z 1996 onwards? And there's no real clear demarcation between those, and there's no real hard evidence, you would say, that that's absolutely the right place to draw the lines. I think some of it is based on real events, like I say, the demographic boom around baby boomers. And then really since then, it's kind of rolling it forward 15 to 20 years, depending on the generation, and thinking about those as groups. I mean, and there's a lot of interest in the US right now, and discussion in the US in particular right now, about why have we got these categories and can we do away with them, because they don't have a scientific basis. And I think that in some ways is a good question, but we're sort of stuck with them now. The genie is out of the bottle in many ways, and because they've become such a shorthand for which group are you in, or talking about different other types of groups, really hard to row back from that and say, actually, we should cut it in a different way. And then, you know, frankly, as well, alternatives like using decades as a cutoff are just as arbitrary in terms of how we would segment people on their birth year. And then fundamentally as well, I mean, I think the disconnect between what how we define these groups, which is in birth year, but what is actually important is what is happening when that each of those cohorts are going through their formative years, so in their teens and early 20s. That's really what the basis of generational difference is in many ways, and why it's important, because you are formed more in those years and you're more connected to your peers and their experience during those years. So in the end, my view on it is effectively, is it useful to have these groupings? Does it tell you something about society and how it's changing that you actually get value from? And I think in the book, I do get value from using these groupings, because there are big differences between generations because they grew up in different sorts of contexts. So answering your question about what's different about millennials and Gen Z and their formative experience, you can absolutely see the impact of the housing price boom and bubble, and then the financial crash on the life course of millennials and Gen X to some degree in the US. You just look at home ownership rates, and it looks like Gen X is going to go up to meet baby boomers and pre-war generation levels of home ownership. And then in the early 2000s, with the housing price boom, and then particularly reinforced by the crash, financial crash, they just deflected away from that life course. And then millennials never really got going in terms of home ownership, and they're only just now starting to get into it, but still at much lower levels. So utterly different life courses for those groups on that factor, just depending on when they were born. If they were born a couple of decades earlier, many more of those cohorts would have owned their own home, with all the knock-on effects that has for wealth generation and security and ability to save for the future. So it's those types of events are the really, really important things in shaping a generation. Those big things like economic crises, crashes, or booms. Things like a pandemic is obviously a very generation shaping event. Small things like, you know, some attempts in the past have tried to name generations after games consoles, like the Nintendo generation, or and now we have the TikTok generation, or whatever. Those are not the kind of big things that really shape a whole cohort. You've got to look for the major structural changes in society.
Something like Jean Twing, I think that's her name, like the iGen, you know, calling a generation of based on iPhones or telephones. I think that's fairly accurate, right? Because it's a phenomenon that lasted well to this day, and it's been, I forgot how many years since the first iPhone, and it really did shape a whole generation. Do you find that there's a carryover effect from generation to generation? For example, from baby boomers to say millennials, that millennials looked at their parents buying houses and all that, and they said, you know what, I could do the same thing. And now that, for example, millennials went through this experience with the Great Recession in 2008, their kids are less likely to own a house because their parents didn't own a house.
Yeah, I mean, like, absolutely. So one of the big stories for now and the next 10 or 20 years is going to be the intergenerational transfer of life chances, really. Because we've had this enormous growth in private wealth, driven by housing booms, stock market rises, pension kind of changes. quantitative easing, pumping a lot of money into the economy, and it's been concentrated at the top of the age range, among baby boomers mostly, but only among some baby, not all baby boomers clearly are rich or have a lot of wealth or made it big. So it's been concentrated among a subset of that older generation. And so how that wealth flows down to future generations is really, really important now, because it's going to flow down very unevenly. And we're already seeing it now, but it will continue to grow as a phenomenon, is the extent to which your life chances are increasingly set by the resources that your parents have. Because, you know, increased student debt, still high house prices, wage stagnation means that wealth is much more important to your life chances than income nowadays compared to the past. And that is being concentrated. So there is this risk of, you know, some commentators, academics talk about it as a funnel of privilege. Others talk about it as an incipient caste society, where you're born determines your life chances, who you're born to, the circumstances you're born to. And I think that's, you know, that's obviously not new, but it's becoming more accentuated because of this very uneven spread of wealth, huge growth in wealth and very uneven spread in it among that older population. So yes, absolutely, it's the interaction between generations and economic inequality is really, really important. Sometimes people, when they talk about generations, say it's just the distraction from the real issue is inequality, and that some people are rich and others are poor, or structural discrimination of different sorts. But really, the real story is the interaction between those two things and how that's affecting whether people really do have an opportunity to make it for themselves.
Yeah, and what effect do you think that the media has on these quote unquote generation wars? I'm referencing this while also reading a book by a man named Andrew Yang, who ran for president of the United States and was a huge proponent of universal basic income and all that. But and he describes a situation in Iowa where he was campaigning, with three candidates that nobody else knew, himself, who nobody knew at the time, and this guy who, Michael Avenatti in the United States, who was defending Stormy Daniels, who was accusing Donald Trump of certain affairs. And he realized in the book, and I think it's an accurate representation of the media, that the media didn't come to these events to figure out, oh, this person is really interesting, that person is really interesting. They came with a preconceived notion of what they wanted to write, and they just confirmed their biases in some ways. Do you find the same similar situation to be with the generation wars, that they kind of inflame these divides?
Yeah, no, very much so. I think it's you kind of touched on one of the key devices that I use in the book, really, to try to separate the myths from reality. So if you think about how societies change and individuals change, there's only really three effects that explain all types of change, which are cohort effects, where one generation is different from another and stays different, and, you know, to do with when they were socialized. But you also have life cycle effects, where we do change as we age, where we go through particular life events and that changes our perspective on things like getting married, having kids, getting a job, retiring, all of those types of things kind of affect us. And then you have period effects, where something in the context changes, and it affects all of us to some degree. And the reason I explain that is because I think the reason that we feel like we have a culture war between generations now is not because we have a particularly unusual set of younger generations coming through right now. It's often set up as we have an unusual extreme younger generation that are either snowflakes or social justice warriors coming through right now. But when I look at the evidence of difference in attitudes on social and cultural issues like race or gender or sexuality, those types of things, the gaps between young and old today, there are gaps, significant gaps between young and old today, but they're no different from the gaps between young and old in the past. The issues change over time. It may be more about gender identity now than homosexuality that people are divided on by age. But the gaps between young and old are not that different. In fact, in some ways, baby boomers were more different from their parents than young people are from baby boomers today.
In what ways?
In the sense of if you go back to, say, the late 80s or early 1990s, the pre-war generations were more than twice as likely than baby boomers to think that a woman's place was in the home and men should go out to work. So you get like 60-odd%, two-thirds of pre-war generation saying that's the normal course, that's what it should be, whereas under 30% of baby boomers who thought that at that time. So there's these big gaps on gender roles between the generations. And what we see now is, you know, quite similar differences between young and old on things like race or support for particular movements like Black Lives Matter or whatever else. You can see big gaps between young and old or on trans identity or gender identity more generally. So the issues have changed, but the gaps are similar, if not slightly smaller, between young and old. So what I argue is that what we're actually seeing is a period effect, not a cohort effect. And the period effect is that today we have a much more divided, fractious, extreme media and social media environment where we're kind of built into the system. We have built into the system a focus on the extremes. So you get to hear more from the extreme views on either side mm-hmm. of a debate than you would do in the past. So it gives this impression that we've got two camps facing off against each other with utterly opposed views on each of these types of sensitive issues, when actually that's not the case in reality among the public in general. It is not nearly as divided or extreme as you see, as it seems. So that's a period effect where it affects these types of things. So it does feel more divided on those types of cultural issues right now, but it's not to do with having a particularly unusual gap between young and old. The gap between young and old is completely natural, and in fact society needs that in order to keep moving forward. There's a lot of thought experiments by Comte and Mannheim and lots of others about if we lived forever as individuals, society would end up as a stagnant pond because we get stuck in our ways as individuals, whereas society needs these fresh ideas from young people coming through. So yeah, that's a really crucial distinction. The generational element to the culture wars is exaggerated stroke created by the environment, not by the generations themselves.
Yeah, I've always felt, I mean, I've felt for a little while now that the relationship between generations and how people call each other, or, you know, some of them you outline in your book, like I've heard this myself on numerous occasions where people during COVID would call it the boomer remover, and which is not pretty. They would call millennials and Gen Z snowflakes. And as you mentioned before, what I find interesting is, I think it's also repetition, right? Like the media keeps, or people keep repeating that we're divided. And at a point you start to believe this myth. While, I don't know, I've found that if you're willing to have a conversation and be open-minded with anybody, nobody's going to curse you out in person like they would online. So there's this disconnect from what you see on social media, and social media is very divided. If you go on Twitter and you read the comment section, it's very divided. But I don't think society is Twitter is representative of society, you know. So I think it's just people repeating the same thing, and that's why we follow along.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like the boomer remover thing drew a lot of attention, but it was, you know, a handful of people using it, and then everyone else, including young people, effectively saying, no, that's not something we want to talk about or agree and completely disagree with. And if you look at how people actually behaved rather than what a few people said on Twitter or other social media platforms, the real picture of the pandemic is incredible compliance among young people, among everyone, but including young people, with measures that are mainly about protecting older people and the vulnerable. And enormous sacrifices really is the big story here. We didn't expect people to be quite so. I know, you know, not everyone has, but the extent of compliance with changing our lives in order to protect the health of other people has been incredible worldwide. And that's the real story, not the blown up, unrepresentative examples. And you're right about the repeated point. There's something called illusory truth bias, which is the second time you hear a lie, you're more likely to believe it just through repetition, because of the way our brains work is when you hear things a lot, we accept it more likely, it is more likely to be true. And that is the case. If you're bombarded with these types of messages, even if you know it's not really representative, it's something sticks with you. There must be some element of truth to this, and that is a problem. That is a problem when you have an information environment that's incentivized to draw attention to the extremes.
Yeah, you just mentioned that, you know, young people and pretty much everyone was very compliant during the COVID lockdowns and all. Not to sound cynical, but do you think that could also be self-preservation rather than caring for different generations or for your elderly or just, you know, I want to look out for myself?
Yeah, no, of course. I'm a sort of, it relates to a broader point I make in the book about young people today have got like a lot of justification to be really angry about the economic circumstances that they've had grown up with compared to, you know, growth in wages and wealth that previous generations saw. But you don't see much rebellion or active revolt among young people. And there's lots of reasons for that. Part of it is love, because we're very connected up and down the generations through our families. But there is an element of that which is less altruistic and is more about we need to support old people, because if they don't get the support, then we're going to end up having to do it ourselves and looking after our parents and grandparents, and that takes time or money, so you need to get some level of support or success for them, or else it will fall on us. And there is a third element, which is we don't have much evidence or indication about how we'll be treated as older people ourselves, apart from how we treat old people today. It's one of the indicators of if we all age is very unusual as a characteristic, because we will all go through the different age ranges. We won't necessarily change genders. We won't change ethnicities. We won't necessarily change socioeconomic groups or classes, but we will all change age groups, or we'll die. We've only got two options. We either get older or die. So we've got a connection to older people that you don't have with other types of demographic factors. And that's not all altruistic or love-based. It is selfish. Some of it is selfish. And so absolutely, I think there is an element of self-interest in this for those sorts of reasons, a number of different reasons.
Yeah. Do we have any data on how the relationship of the younger generation with the older generation has changed over time?
Oh, it's really interesting. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting. I mean, there's really good data on time use data on that we spend much more time with our kids than we used to. So parenting is more intense and more time is spent on childcare than we did in the past. And it's just a kind of cultural change. So there's an increased connection in that sort of very tight nuclear family type element to it. But then counter to that, we have got the most age segregated society that we've ever seen. It's like a really, there's academics in the US who talk about it as a dangerous experiment in age segregation. It's and there's an absolute mirror of that in the UK, where up until 1990s, towns and small rural, smaller villages and rural areas, and compared with cities, there was not much difference in terms of the age profile of those types of geographical areas. But when you got to the 2010s, huge differences, where young people have sorted themselves into cities, older people staying in suburbs and more rural areas. And it's the same sort of patterns in the US, just happened a bit earlier. And that is like a new thing. That is, societies generally tended to be mixed up by age in terms of where people lived. So that separation is helps fuel some of these stereotypes about, because we don't have so much contact with each other. And just as you were saying, when you talk to people, you tend to see that you're not as different from them as you think, and there's more in common. But if you're living in completely different areas, you start to think very differently about the other group. And then on top of that, you've also got digital lives. Our digital lives are more important to us now than in the past, what we do online. And while it's true that more older people are online than in the past, they're still in very different places to young people. They're on different platforms, doing different sorts of things, mostly. So we've got a digital separation in our lives too. So I think that one of the key themes of the book is our problem is not so much war or conflict between generations as separation between generations. We've drifted apart in a way that we just didn't in the past. So that is a problem. That is one of the big challenges, particularly because lots of great work that shows intergenerational connection benefits both sides, both the young and the old. Younger people get to learn from the experience of older people. Older people get that sort of connection to the future and helping shape future generations.
Yeah, what surprised me is you just mentioned, if I'm not mistaken, the younger generation is spending more time with their kids. Is that correct?
Yeah, no, we had a long-term trend of increased parenting time. Yeah, absolutely. And it's partly, domestic. Sorry, go ahead.
Sorry, but that's a little surprising to me because, as you mentioned before, with, the baby boomer generation, the generation before that, there was always a higher likelihood that one parent would stay home with the kids. And I associate that with spending time with that kid because you're home. Now you have, I would assume, I don't know the data completely, you have fewer households like that. You have more parents working full time and then spending time with their kids. So how do younger generations spend more time with their kids?
Yeah, I mean, it's partly because of the kind of household chores aspect of life has been enormously constrained, enormously reduced because of automate, all the technology that we have, the amount of time that I was born to a baby boomer, into a baby boomer parent. And while my mum only worked part-time, she had didn't have the sort of technology of the home technology so she spent a lot of her time cleaning, cooking, doing all these other types of things, washing, in a way that is much more automated now. So, I mean, that's part of the reason for it. But there has also been a squeeze on leisure time. A lot of the time that I had outside of school and outside of work hours would have been just being left to myself in a way that they would go off to the pub and we'd be left, you'd be left on your own. Or you'd be kicked out of the house and said, don't come back till it's dark, and go out and you just play in a kind of free range kid type of way. And there's much more active involvement in kids' lives these days. I feel that myself as a father of a 12-year-old and a 9-year-old. We're much more involved in their lives at the weekends and in the evenings than my parents would have been. There's a kind of shifting cultural norm as well as a technological change.
That's really interesting. In spite of all these at times positive factors and some obviously there are going to be negative factors, why are people so pessimistic for the future of their kids and grandkids and they don't see a path towards upward mobility? This is kind of like a two-part question or three-part question, really. Mm-hmm. So there's that. And then you cite polls in your book of how of saying that people in the West are more pessimistic about the future for their kids and grandkids, while people in, say, Asian countries, I think Singapore, you said, or some other country, are more optimistic. What kinds of questions are asked in these kinds of polls? How do they get to these issues? How do they find this data? And the last is, how do you see this phenomena tied to your previous work with your last book, Why We're Wrong About Nearly Everything?
Yeah, interesting. So on the first part, the question is whether you think today's youth will have a better or worse life than their parents. What you've seen is exactly as you describe. You've got less developed countries where the majority are think it's going to be better. And then the more developed countries, including UK, US, and particularly France, interestingly, very pessimistic about the future for their kids, think it's more like think it's going to be worse rather than better. So only 13% of people in France think the future is going to be better for kids today than it was for their parents. And the real driver of that is those big economic changes. We kind of got used to post-war generation on generation improvement in incomes, lifestyle, life chances, more generally. But we've had for some time now wage stagnation, these problems with home ownership and wealth generation generally. And of course, we've got, you know, big existential crises looming around climate that are more prominent now than were for our parents. Not that they didn't exist, but just become more prominent now. And so that is a real phenomenon. And you can kind of see it as it's in the UK, it's been a real turnaround. In 2003, half of people thought the future was going to be better for kids than their parents, only a quarter thought it'd be worse. Now those figures are reversed, where you've got half think it's going to be worse and a quarter think it's going to be better. The US goes up and down a bit more, but there was certainly at the end of the 1990s, much more optimism that the future was going to be better for kids than there is now. This is pre-pandemic, that won't help clearly. So there's a real thing there, and it's mostly driven, I suppose, by that disconnect between our expectations of generation on generation progress. When you ask people whether your kid's doing better than you is important to you, you get 70 to 80% of people saying, yes, it is. That is an important thing. We like to give on a better future to our children than we had ourselves. Quite important to us as individuals. But the connection to the misperceptions point is a really useful, really interesting one, because one of the big themes of that book is that things are not as bad as we think in many ways. That we have this tendency to think things are worse and getting worse than they really are. and we forget about the progress that we've made. So I think there is an element of that in this sort of trend, is that we've got those big economic factors in mind, but we tend to forget the progress that we've made in other sorts of ways when we come to those assessments about education levels or health capability, healthcare capabilities, or the cultural improvements that we see in the opportunities for travel. All of this is all pre-pandemic, I guess. But so yes, we tend to err on the side of pessimism about the direction of travel we have gone in and what the future looks like. The difference, I think, from on this subject, though, is that there is a real truth underlying the fact that it has got worse for recent generations, that economically it is tougher, it has been tougher, and progress has stagnated or reversed for lots of groups. And so that is a real thing. That is not a misperception among people. That is based on that type of fact. But it's also a partial view, because other things have improved for generations in all sorts of other ways.
Mm. So to begin wrapping up in the interest of time, I ask two questions at the end of my podcast to every guest, and I'll bundle them together and you can answer in whatever order you please. The first one is, what gives you hope for the future? And the second question is, what are 5 books, fiction or nonfiction, they don't have to be your favorite, that you would recommend to people?
Oh, wow. I didn't know those were coming. They're really good questions. I should have thought about those. So reasons for optimism. I think the biggest reason I have for optimism is through looking at the long-term trends historically. I think what gives me hope is looking back to previous times where everything felt lost, or that it was going downhill, or heading towards an inevitable crisis. So this, what stands out really, is the 1970s for lots of countries, where it seemed like people were losing faith in the economy and the democratic system. And you could find an awful lot of commentary then that looks like commentary now, that we are heading towards an inevitable crisis, and it's all going to end in a big conflict. And that some generational thinking tends towards emphasizing that we're in there's an inevitable decline coming, or inevitable crisis coming. But what I take from those looking at those longer term trends is that things change, and things change because we have agency over them. This is not all set in stone when you look at how bad things were in the past, and then a few years later things had improved significantly for people in terms of their attitudes or their lives. And that's really important, because generational stereotypes and myths kind of contribute, or simplifications of the characters of different generations contribute to that sense of decline, or that everything is set and there's nothing we can do. So my cause for optimism is, everything that I see in the evidence is there's very clearly things that were changed because of action that was taken. So it's still in our hands, I guess, is the cause for optimism. On books, I suppose I am currently reading an awful lot about culture wars, and revisiting an awful lot of culture war literature. So I think in terms of what I'm learning a lot from is going back to James Davison Hunter and Culture War book from 1991, and looking at Liliana Mason's Uncivil Agreement, and trying to learn from that, and looking at Ezra Klein's, more recently, Ezra Klein's Why We're Polarized, and each of those books kind of add to my understanding of a path that we may be on in the UK, unfortunately, following some of the US trends towards these cultural division. So I would pick, if I can get away with three rather than five.
Sure,
I would pick out those three as sort of markers of different understandings of how and why these things happen, in order to hopefully understand how we can avoid a similar sort of outcome in the UK.
Great. I wanted to first say thank you for coming onto the podcast and speaking with me. Recommend your book, The Generation Myth. I'll show it one more time. And wish you the best of luck with the book launch.
No, thank you. It's been great talking to you. Great questions.
Thank you. All the best.
Thank you.